Blog Talk Radio.
Companion, your host Dale Graham. Great to have you back. Grim day today. Grim. This is our commemoration to the day that we remember a lot of men and women who died the First World War. 100 years. It's not exactly something that fits the word ceremony, not least in my mind. Okay. 37 million people died, all in. 37 million, it's like the entire country of Canada was wiped off the face of the earth. Oh, it's hard to believe, the pain. Better that I pretend, better that I watch. I was always saddened by the misery of old soldiers. I didn't see them prancing about. I saw them very solemn, remembering their comrades. I didn't aggrandize them because I was taught that that was mockery. The soldiers seemed to have difficulty erasing their experience, the experience of the front lines, from this political sense of nobility. Not when they were pulling the pieces of their best friend together to put in a bag to send back to his mom. 61,000 Canadians died. There were whole communities, like some of the regiments from Newfoundland. Newfoundland wasn't part of Canada then. That happened in 1949, remember? But they sent brave men. Every man in one Newfoundland community died in one battle on the first day. Dear me. 61,000 of us. The country wasn't very big then. Back then, the authorities identified 9,000 Canadians as suffering from shell shock. They didn't have the advantage of contemporary science. I don't know whether, the boys and girls that are dying from suicide, we're hearing the rates are much higher than being suppressed, except between veterans. So today, I'm honoring the veterans who are standing up to a government that has been inauthentic, even though you can't really give much more than your life to serve your country and for the country to lie and mislead and politicize, and say one thing that they're going to do and then do nothing, and actually cut back on services and supports. And the very least we can do is show that their effort, the effort of all of those people that were left on the battlefield, mattered deeply. So today I'd like the veterans out there and the relatives of veterans to hear this. Our politicians aren't Canada. Canada is us, you and me. And you and me care a great deal. So, You'll hear enough about this, and I won't intrude into the privacy of your own thoughts. But when a man or young woman stands up and does the right thing and dies for it, we call it bravery. They might simply say, as you hear time and time again, just doing my job. And truly thank God for that. Anyway, it's the 313th day of the year. There's only 52 days left before New Year's Eve, so I hope I'll see you on New Year's Eve, will I? Departure here, if you don't mind. Masonic Companion tries to bring the discussion to you, so it's a little more accessible. Yeah, we're in the 21st century, so we're using all the tools, none replace sitting down with you and pouring a glass of our favorite and talking, getting to know each other, and listening to hear what you've been studying and reading and thinking. I'm not really too skillful anymore at tolerating loose tongues. And maybe I should start referring to myself as Little Cyril, because my grandfather, very worshipful brother Toombs, had this reputation of being a gruff old bastard. I always knew him as my wonderful grandfather that would teach me things when I was trying to keep up with him in a plowed field. You know, I was a little guy, little legs. But he talked to me seriously. As if I was a full person with a brain, and he was teaching me Masonic values. Ah, the best. Anyway, those values resonate through good people. He was the one that taught me we didn't need police. Good men didn't need police to tell them how to live. Good men, he in his mind, were honest men. So sorry out there to everybody that thinks the butt of a rifle stock is the only way to, push me in the back and get me to do things. Well, never going to work. The departure here, though, is to take the show a bit sideways. A bit. Considerably more sideways. And do something that I think it's been on the bucket list for some time for the program. And we're going to explore more of the mind. We're going to go, hopefully, the Masonic Companion will be a safe way for you to explore things that, you know, you don't want to admit in public, because you don't know how to admit it or how to talk about it. And that's the occult nature of Freemasonry. I'm afraid of that. I think that there's an alchemist inside every person who takes the obligations of a Mason. Anyone who thinks Masonry is uniform values would be erasing thousands of years of history. Who can tell what motivates change and progress, or even if there is a single trigger? Our very presence suggests objective assessment. What could be a greater threat to status quo than created by any degree of manipulation? Not status quo that, you know, is balanced and occurs out of natural law, but what could be the greater threat to, you know, those swarmy little backroom deals, the clever little oily operators, you know, that are wringing their hands and standing on the pork barrel? What could be a better threat than the man who is known for balance? Careful observers can distinguish the difference between culture and politics, loyalty and ignorance. Choosing to avoid serious study of religion sparks controversy on all sides and obscures the truth. The Mason separates faith, the truth, from its irascible cousin, religion. Distillation, the tool of alchemy, shows the presence of faith in the mixture of religious practice. a presence beyond the limits of the mind, the being not created but supreme. Fundamentalism and zealotry can be incendiary, so we need to handle those elements properly and avoid explosions. Why conflict? Why rudeness? Somewhere in our minds we have a scale. If we have been wronged, it justifies the release of offensive activity to balance the scoreboard. How in the world did winning infect our reasoning? Scoreboard. It's like saying it's about winning. One up. I have to be one up on you. If I take offense out of something you've said, I have to assume that it was deliberate, don't I? Because, gee, I'm a genius here. And everything coming out of my mind must be absolute truth. So it's a scoreboard. I can be mean back and I can be rude back in response. Except Mason's values remind him not to do that. Remind him, get control of your emotion. 14-year-olds, everything is in a state of emotional exploration. Surely to goodness we can do better than that. Oh, control of emotion is not burying head in sand. Nope. That's what we call ignorance. Why then are Masons expected to be reflective? And how do we come to that state of mind? Why? If we admit there is an alchemist inside each one of us, then we reveal each member is a seeker of knowledge and truths. Today, Masonic Companion remembers the men and women who fought the First World War. However we do it, we must agree those lives were given up for a noble purpose. If we must lie to do that, what does that say about the progress of humanity? Rest in peace. Wow. It's also the 25th anniversary of the Berlin Wall being broken down. The reunification of great peoples. It's hard, you know. There are certain people that do commit certain crimes, and in my mind, I like to think of them as maybe I take a lesson from the Egyptians. Their name is not mentioned again. No child will ever be given that name. It's erased from our history and from our minds. But I want to say this to you. Maybe you'll agree with it, maybe you won't. That every time, any time, we lose track of our need to live in harmony, if we lose track of the fact that our immortality is based on our capacity to be loved and our capacity to love, there will always be some narcissist, some psychopath that will rise up to claim the moral high ground on behalf of all of us in a very authoritarian style. There will always be one of them, one of us, that will do that until we get rid of him or her or it. And we always will, because that's an offense to any thinking person. So the message out there to all those folks that are selling this business that good men need to be told what to do. Don't ever assume that leadership is ordering people around. Don't make that mistake. You know, people with that kind of attitude and a little bit of authority need to be watched constantly, because if we don't, history teaches us that Authority always becomes overbearing. Always. It's the natural flow of that stream. So we always need to keep it under our thumb. Some of countries are not mentioned, but the one south of us hasn't quite figured out still how to do that. Oh, Canada. You want to hear a little bit of something interesting? Well, sit back. I hope that you're in a good frame of mind, because I want to start to talk to you about alchemy. Alchemy. This is the stuff that I think embarrasses people. I think there's a fear we have to overcome. The thing that you're going to study the occult, that you're an occultist, bring to mind the sanctions of the churches of what? 11th century, 12th century, 13th century? Of course it does. The churches used authority as if, you know, back in the day, religion and military might was blurred, wasn't it? And then often it was a fluid movement from one to the other. And with it came a prescription for the way things were going to be and our place in it. We didn't realize the collective power that mankind had. We still didn't, even though the Greeks gave the lesson to us. They didn't. We had to find that out through battling it out. And, man, we did that, eh? We had to suffer. We had to pay a price. And then decide in balance whether that price was legitimate or not. We had the Holy Inquisition. I'm not pointing a finger at anyone's faith. There's been, I'm sure, you know, atrocities committed in the name of any of these faiths. Now it's like these things have become like a game on a children's video. No. We play with them. We play with battle scenes as if that makes them, you know, that's the real excitement, is watching us virtually kill people. just sick, huh? Well, we can, you know, it's like we're salivating over the bear pit. We're watching putting the bear in the pit and setting our hunting dogs on it and laying bets at the market, at the fair, and watching the animal torn apart. Makes us proud, eh? 21st century people. According to some researchers, about 125,000 people were investigated by the Spanish Inquisition. Only about, you know, 1 or 2% of them were actually executed. Can you imagine? There's a famous inquisitor. They even became Bernard Guy was one of the most notorious medieval inquisitors. So much so that his name has become pornographic. You know, what could be more pornographic than the degradation of human beings? Sick. He tried out 930 people. Killed 42 of them. Unbelievable, eh? So that was the 16th and 17th century. Remember the mindset that created the values, that pulled together the values and that galvanized into the constitutional recognition of Masonry. So the mindsets. there were remarkable things happening at that time. This is a period where the clock was being developed. Remember, we talked just last week about the tragedy at the Scilly Islands in the 15th century that caused the government to put out requests for inventors to come forward, and they incentivized the whole thing with significant cash rewards. And of course, we know that the Dutchman Huygens was given credit for developing a reliable clock that would be useful for men roaming the seas, people roaming the seas. So have we progressed out of those days? This, what I'll get into here today, would have me killed or investigated and likely killed. What courage would there be? Lie and live, tell the truth, and be killed by idiots. Does it matter? The ignominious death of a good man is still the ignominious waste. It will be apparent that it is difficult to discern which properties each thing possesses in reality. That came from the 8th century Democritus, the speaker was. Yeah. We can't talk about the development of alchemy without talking about how we get there. And I'll be honest with you, there's times where I understand the literal definition of the word occult. I get that. I just have difficulty joining the dots. Occultus, it comes from a Latin, occultus or clandestine or hidden, knowledge of the hidden. It's in common, we use it today to refer to the paranormal as opposed to some knowledge that's measurable, you know. So we laugh at it, don't we? Yes, it's like serious-minded. Well, we can't take that serious. This is, Kubler-Ross communing with the dead. How do we reconcile that? Oh, what if they're right? Well, there's something else that's being missed. It's that desire for truth and knowledge. The term is sometimes taken to mean that it is meant only for certain people or that the knowledge must be kept hidden. But for most practicing occultists, it's simply a deeper study of spiritual reality. And it goes beyond pure reason and the physical sciences. So if you have difficulty with that, then turn the show off. Go away. So you'll hear, esoteric and occult used interchangeably. They have very similar meanings. So does arcane. So when you hear these terms, in this application, I'm using them to define and describe a pursuit of a deeper, hidden, metaphysical, that which isn't obvious, metaphysical knowledge. And from that knowledge, we may or may not be able to determine truths. So it is a quest for that. And it happens with Hindu, Jewish, Christian views. Yeah. Christian authorities have generally regarded occultism as heretical. From early Christian times, the form of Gnosticism to late Renaissance times, in forms of occult philosophy. Though there's a Christian occult tradition that goes back at least to Renaissance times. That's when a fellow by the name of Marsilio Ficino, Icino, developed a Christian Hermeticism, and Pico della Mirandola developed a Christian form of Kabbalism. These are mainstream institutional Christianity has always resisted these influences, yeah. But there are heterodox branches of esoteric Christianity that practice divination and blessings or appealings to angels for certain intervention, which they view as perfectly righteous, often supportable by gospel. Think of it, they're claiming that the old commandment against divination was superseded by Christ's birth. And then pay attention that the Magi used astrology to locate Bethlehem. Astrology. Force of the stars and position of the planets. Rosicrucianism is one of the most celebrated of Christianity's mystical offshoots, and it's lent aspects of its philosophy to most Christian-based occultism since the 17th century, 1600s, eh? Now, what would a Hindu say about this? Tantra, literally, that means formula or method or the way, and also having the secondary meaning of thread or warp and woof, you know, is the name scholars give to a style of religious ritual and meditation that arose in medieval India about 5th century. And this began to influence all forms of Asian religions. Tantra is at the same time as a method of psychoanalysis, a way of integrating the mind and body and spirit, in a way of using the mind or will to cause change in one's external situations and circumstances. Doing that is known as magic. It includes amongst its various branches a variety of ritualistic practices ranging from visualization exercises and the chanting of mantras to elaborate rituals. So, alchemy, astrology, herbalism, yogic practices, sex magic, and trance also together form the multifaceted and multi-level nature of Tantra. Yantra, literally the instrument or tool, are geometric diagrams considered to be the subtle or finer representation of the psychological or natural powers that are the deities, the proper use of which could result in the yantra becoming activated and infused with the particular powers and capabilities of the deity for the practitioner, adept, student, to put to his use, my use. Occult concepts have existed in the Vedic stream too. These are things that we'll get into a bit later, but if you want to do your own research on them, Vedic, V-E-D-I-C. The Atharva Veda, representing an independent tradition markedly different from the other three Vedas, it's a rich source parallel of the Vedic traditions of the Rig, Sam, and Yajurvedas, containing detailed descriptions of different kinds of magical rituals for different results, ranging from punishing enemies to the acquisition of wealth, health, long life, or good harvest. In Rabbinic Judaism, an entire body of literature collectively known as Kabbalah has been dedicated to the content eventually defined by some as occult science. The Kabbalah, or Kabbalah, includes the tracts named Sefer Yetzirah, the Sohar, Pardes, Rimon, and Itz Sham. Boy, did I... The Hebrew students will tell me that I butchered those names. I apologize. Although there is a popular myth that one must be a 40-year-old Jewish man and learned in the Talmud before one is learned to delve into Kabbalah, Shem Vital says exactly the opposite in his introduction to Itz Sham. There, he argues that it is incumbent on everyone to learn Kabbalah, even those who are unable to understand the Talmud. Further, the father of the Lurianic school of Kabbalah, Isaac Luria, known as Ari Hashkadosh, or the Holy Lion, was not yet 40 years old when he passed away. And followers of the Hellenic religious views, the Reconstructionist polytheists, reject magic and occultism on the basis that it pretends to force or compel the gods into taking action. Also because severe laws were enacted against magic by the Athenian Assembly. So let's get into it, shall we? Together, just to explore the surface. We're not doing anything more than trying to figure out what the hell it is. What is it that we're talking about? A rich world of images has etched itself into the memory of modern man, despite the fact that it is not available in public collections, but lies hidden in the old manuscripts and prints. True. These are the eternal halls of Los, the prophet of the imagination, which are filled with the exemplary images and Platonic figures that govern our understanding of the world and ourselves, and of which the poet William Blake wrote. Now, Blake was a poet. He was born in 1757 and died in 1827. He wrote that all things acted on earth are seen in them, and that every age renews its powers from these works. So go on. William Blake, pull that off your shelf. I think you'll see a connection. Now, we're only looking at threads. Don't get too far ahead of us. If any of this does not challenge our sense of reason, then we're doing it wrong. This is about what happens when we begin to park our sense of reason. It's still there. But then we begin to explore if there's anything else around the edges of that. Is there anything else around the edge of reason? Well, it apparently includes quite a bit. I like to think of it as dark matter, you know. It's playful and it's contemporary with, you know, concurrent physics. So I like to think of it that way, at least applying that notion of physics to mind. And I'm reminded myself that years ago in Masonic Companion, I brought up the work of Madame Blavatsky. Yeah, that discredited sort of prophet of the early 20th century. Yeah, I did. So this is not exactly virgin territory for the program. We have traces of this hidden in linguistic riddles and picture puzzles. This is where secrets were hidden with special hieroglyphic features. And the creators of pictures sought to suggest the very great age of their art to acknowledge the source of their wisdom. The patriarch of natural mysticism and alchemy was Hermes Trismegistus. You've heard this name. It always puts together vowels and that are hard for me to pick, for my ear to put together. It was a Greek colonist in late classical Egypt. Yes, Greek colonist in late classical Egypt, just in case this was getting too easy, who identified their healing winged messenger of the gods Hermes with the ancient Egyptian Thoth, or Thoth, T-H-O-T-H, the thrice greatest. Thoth was the god of writing and magic, worshipped like Hermes as the psychopompos, the soul's guide through the underworld, psychopompos. The mythical figure of Hermes Trismegistus was also linked to a legendary pharaoh who was supposed to have taught the Egyptians all their knowledge of natural and supernatural things, including their knowledge of hieroglyphic script. The alchemists saw him as their Moses, who had handed down the divine commandments of their art in the Emerald Tablet, the Tabula Sumerina, now believed to date back to the 6th to 8th century AD. It became known in the Christian world after the 14th century through translations from the Arabic. There was hardly a single alchemist in either the laboratory or the speculative mystical camp who was not prepared to bring his discoveries into line with the solemn and verbatim message of these 12 truths. True, true, without doubt, certain, the below is as the above, and the above is as the below, to perfect the wonders of the One. And as all things came from the One, from the meditation of the One, so all things are born from this One by adaptation. Its father is the sun, its mother the moon. The wind carries it in its belly, its nurse is the earth. It is the father of all the wonders of the whole world. Its power is perfect when it is transformed into earth. Separate the earth from fire and the subtle from the gross, cautiously and judiciously. It ascends from earth to heaven and then returns back to the earth, so that it receives the power of the upper and the lower. And thus you will possess the brightness of the whole world, and all darkness will flee you. This is the force of all forces, for it overcomes all that is subtle and penetrates solid things. Oh. Are you saying this is like neutrinos? This was the world created. From this, wonderful adaptations were effected, and the means are given here. And Hermes Trismegistus is my name, because I possess the three parts of the wisdom of the whole world. Also from Hermes, messenger of the gods, comes hermeneutics, the art of textual interpretation, and according to the author of the Book of the Holy Trinity, 1415, the first alchemical text in the German language. This occurs in four directions: the natural, supernatural, divine, and human sense. As used by its most distinguished representatives, alchemical literature possesses a suggestive language, rich in allegories and wordplay, often through the meditation of Jacob Boehme's theosophical works, has had a profound effect on the poetry of Romanticism. Again, they point us to Blake and Novalis to learn more about the philosophy of the German idealism of Hegel and Schelling, and on modern literature. So, can you imagine that we'll find threads of this in Yeats, Joyce, Rimbaud, Breton, and Artaud? Many voices, even from within their own ranks, were raised against the obscure idioms of the alchemists, and their own account of their communication technique hardly sounds more engaging. Whatever we have spoken openly, we have actually said nothing. But where we have written something in code and in pictures, we have concealed the truth. That comes from the Wyndham edition of the Rosarium Philosophum. Anyone who inadvertently enters this linguistic arena will suddenly find himself in a chaotic state of references, a network of constantly changing code names and symbols for arcane substances in which everything can always apparently mean everything else, and which even specialist Baroque dictionaries and modern lists of synonyms provide few clues. This kind of profusion of diffuse concepts always required simplifying measures. These might be said to include the influential attempts at interpretation by the Swiss psychoanalyst C.G. Jung, who was solely interested in the internal nature of the hybrid form of alchemy and only acknowledged its external chemical workings as the scientific projection of psychological developments. Chewy meal, But the Hermetic philosophers can be heard more freely, distinctly, or clearly with a silent speech or within speech in the illustrations of the mysterious, both in the riddles presented in the figures and the words. So what I take from this is we're going to find ourselves falling into a chaotic system of references where there's constantly changing code names and symbols of arcane substances, where things can mean one thing and then they can mean everything. I have that, my logical mind has a great deal of difficulty following this. I want to push it back into the way I've been taught to look at things much differently through reason. It's easier, or it's more comfortable. It's like that's the skill that I know. At least I think I do know how to reason things out. This is telling me that I should look at things sideways. So I'll pick that up. I don't want to do too much of this at a time on the program because it is just, I find it hard. It's hard. And I find that as I'm clamoring, it's going over the edge. You know, it's like climbing over jagged rocks. It's not like running along a smooth path. Only the jagged rocks are all of a sudden on the edge of a precipice that slips off on two sides, and it narrows as this journey moves forward. And so to maintain my balance, I have to maintain focus. I have to keep the goal in mind and not think about the perils around on either side, because that will weaken my reserve. I'll become so cautious that I'm not able to proceed, and I'll end up crawling along that edge on my hands and knees if I'm driven to do it. So I'll leave it there for a little while. Go back to something else I want to talk to you about. Is that okay? Are you okay with that? I want to talk to you about this speculation, about one of the most staggering pieces of architecture in the world, I would say. You want to say it's the Guggenheim Museum or the pyramids? By all means. But I think St. Paul's, the product of Christopher Wren. Yeah, let's put it up there. It's, of course, it's not too far away from, you know, it's probably a horse and cart ride to the big Masonic halls. And it fits into the period, you know, in the brain of the 17th and 18th century when social class was pushing on all of us. Now the push in social class is wealth. So we see the ridiculousness of the nouveau riche. Yeah, that constant pathetic display. It was almost like, you know, when they were building those big, huge estates across Britain that looked like train stations. Like, oh, man. I'll hail them because they were built in the day. But what was going through your mind other than displaying your wealth? So, new to the money, were you? At least I like, you know, Kempton Palace was at least taken over. You know, somebody built that, and at least the king went in and said, right, I love this. You're out. You know, Hampton Court. So I like that. You know, he was resilient, a resilient little thief, but nevertheless, and wouldn't you want to give up your ostentatious display of wealth to your monarch? Because if you really ticked him off, he'd just have you disappeared. Ah, dear. If you go into the website of the United Grand Lodge of England, you will find many great Masons listed. But if you find, you will find disappointingly very few architects. Under artists, you'll find William Hogarth and the architect John Soane, but no mention of Christopher Wren. If you start surfing the internet more broadly, you will find conflicting information when it comes to Wren and whether he was a Mason. Some websites state that with absolute certainty, there was no evidence he was a Mason. Some websites say that with absolute certainty, there was no evidence, but while others state that he was definitely a member. And still others say with equal certainty that he was not only a member, but a very high-ranking member. So should you care to look at the books, you will find the results equally confusing. For example, Lisa Jardine, the highly respected Wren scholar, states clearly in her recent biography of Wren that he was a Mason. But some of the most respected writers on Freemasonry are less certain or equally adamant that he was not. So I'm going to turn to the work of Dr. James W.P. Campbell, Brother Campbell, and a paper that was presented to Ars Quattro Coronatim Lodge on the 17th of February, 2012. For those of you who weren't there, you might find this useful. So we have one scholar, foremost scholar on Wren, Lisa Jardine, saying that he was. And then there was other respect, you know, there's more than one respected writer. David Stevenson dismisses his membership entirely. And John Hamill is a bit more cautious, merely stating that Wren's membership is not proven. So whom then do we believe? Why is there so much uncertainty surrounding an apparently simple question? Is there really no evidence? So, for those of you who need to know, stick around. We're going to talk about Wren. He was born in 1632 and he died in 1723. So you know that period, that lovely period leading up to the creation of all things Masonic in 1717. No, of course not. That's when Masonry was redefined. It became redefined. So today, if you ask people about what is Masonry, they give you that, that a system of allegory, veiled immorality. You know, it's like it's so tiring to hear that. It's so worn out. But the truth is, it's beautiful. Veiled in allegory. It is absolutely beautiful. You know? Yeah. Worn out, tired, overspoken, but beautiful. So, Wren is justifiably referred to as England's most famous architect. And if you ask the average person in the street the name of a British architect, this is likely the only person they'll be able to name. The only building of his they will be able to mention is St. Paul's Cathedral. And, of course, we could give a lecture on how Wren's prominence in the common imagination is misplaced. We could really demonstrate that there were many English architects worthy of equal or greater note, but there is no doubt that Wren was the leading figure of his time and holds a peculiar place in the popular imagination. The story of Wren is amazing. How much of that is in the mind of the storyteller? I hope. Great storyteller, great mind. His architectural achievements were most vividly portrayed in Charles Robert Carrel's A Tribute to Christopher Wren, which is now in the Victoria and Albert Museum. In this glorious picture, we see more clearly than any list could portray the sheer number of buildings Wren designed. It was not until the invention of the railways over a century after his death that any architect was to design more. He is still one of the most prolific architects of all time. In addition to St. Paul's, he designed over 50 churches, as well as country houses, royal palaces, libraries, hospitals, college buildings, schools, and interiors. Most lecturers will tell you in detail about his life, assuming you know absolutely nothing but time. Let's skip over all of that. I'm just going to talk about the excellent books on the subject. I think it's worth mentioning that Wren was much more than an architect. He was also a leading promoter of what we could now call science. Before he had built a single building, he had been a leading academic, and he held professorships in astronomy at both London and Oxford, and he was president of the Royal Society. Make a little note there. And indeed, one of its founder members. And he made important discoveries in mathematics, microscopy, and anatomy. And indeed, had he died at the age of 30, he would still have warranted an entry in the Dictionary of National Biography, even though he had not yet built a single building. It was Wren, together with Hooke and Halley, who came up with the idea that gravity obeyed the inverse square law and asked Newton if he could prove it. It was Wren who carried out the first intravenous injection. This, then, is why it matters if Christopher Wren was a Freemason. If Freemasonry wants to prove that it has value and has been supported by great men, Wren would be a good example. Why, then, has any confusion arisen over Wren's membership? Before we can answer that question, it is worth briefly looking at what we know about Freemasonry in the period. In other words, what was it that Wren might have joined? Oh, beer and a hot dog, socialization. That's one side of it. Probably a variant of that was happening at the time. Our knowledge of what Freemasonry may have been like in the 1650s to 1717, that was the period when Wren might have joined, and our knowledge of that period is extremely limited. There are only a handful of surviving historical accounts of Freemasonry from this period, and none of these is terribly revealing. Some points are generally accepted by Masonic historians. First amongst these is that Freemasons' lodges were a sort of club which you joined. Ah, judged a little too fast about the social aspect, didn't you? They generally met in the private upper rooms of taverns and took the name of the tavern concerned. Very practical bunch. So, I'm at the Fox and Hen Lodge over there. We're meeting over there on the first Monday of after the full moon. There you go. They generally met in the private upper rooms of taverns and took the name of the tavern concerned. I love the imagery of this. I think it's just very powerful. Freemasonry today consists of a series of ceremonies or degrees, each carrying with it certain secrets. These are only revealed to the candidates during the ceremonies. Yeah, I wish. Here. But some of them are, yes. There is, however, no mention of system of 3 degrees in the early documents. Masonic historians generally agree that Masonry in the 17th century consisted of just one ceremony, an initiation, and possibly a second degree. Freemasonry was a club or society with special signs of recognition, which allowed Freemasons to visit other lodges and prove they were Masons. None of the early sources reveals that these secrets were or what the initiation ceremony consisted of. Well, in that simple phrase, it's a challenge to the notion that Freemasonry was a club. But think about the time frame that qualifies that statement. In this period of time, it formed as a club. It doesn't say the club came first and the philosophy came after, the values, the ethics, the ethos followed. No, it doesn't. So, for those of you who realize that the thoughts, the threads of reason that can be traced back from Masonry to its earliest documented origin that we can discover, does connect us in some ways with Isis, the study and worship of Isis, Osiris, and Horus. But if you come along and say, does Freemasonry have a connection with Egypt? Well, you know, yeah, I suppose we still like beer, and we still like our ration, and we still like public work, you know. But as our emperor, as the representation, not only the representation of the deity, but the deity, that sort of broke down. Can you see our great fearless leader here in Canada representing the deity? No, there will be some names not mentioned on this program. So one ceremony, and it started as a club. That is how things pulled together. It was much simpler, masonry, in that day than it is what we have now. You became a mason by being initiated in a lodge, and thereafter you might go again or never at all. So this isn't a failing. This going once and never again and paying your dues was one of the, what I call one of the original local traditions. So we haven't failed. We're not over the edge. We just haven't been paying enough attention to our history. And as I've often pointed out, I think that the way we are today is exactly the way we were in the first moments of Masonic development. There is no suggestion that they included lectures or other elaborations at this stage. They were held in taverns, and we can safely presume the meetings also included a certain amount of eating and drinking. So it was an opportunity to get together. That was a big part of it. So if I'm hungry and I don't mind a pint and a meal with my friends, and we're there for the purpose of having this club activity, then there you have it. And then we've gotten into titles and decorations and seem to have, maybe we've just strayed. We've made it a little too, a little too, we've defined it. We've overthought it. We've overthought it, haven't we, boys? We've made it walk this way, turn that way, look this way, sit this way. What the hell? Pull the compasses out of our arse and sit back and get in touch with the fact that we're grown men. We're there to have a talk and a bite and a bit to drink. But not to carry on, not to get so blurred that we can't carry on a sensible conversation. There was no suggestion that they had lectures or elaborations. Although these certainly became part of later 18th century Freemasonry. Freemasonry did, however, retain a certain mystique. On joining it, it required its members to take an oath never to reveal its secrets. Well, we can't find a room full without an idiot that will spill. Put on a uniform and say, tell me all the secrets, and the idiot will say, oh, yeah. Don't even put it on. Just go up and confront the idiot, and he'll spill. No, we've had that time and time again. His oath is worth nothing. An oath in itself is worth nothing unless it's followed by commitment. Is your word worth nothing? Don't value your own word, then don't expect me to value it. You display your foolishness every time you open your mouth. Commitment. Commitment isn't something that's ascribed to you, given to you. It's something you earn. The legitimacy of your word. This secrecy was part of its appeal, and much as today, speculation abounded among non-members as to what the society and those secrets might be about. Rumors circulated among non-Masons that Masons were Rosicrucians or were... Jeez, looks like they're reading our script here today. It is also important to understand that in the late 17th century and early 18th century, London was full of clubs. Livery companies were effectively clubs which drew members from all walks of life and had initiations and dinners. Yep. So, you're thinking this was the first or the only one? Get over yourself, buddy. The Royal Society, which Wren helped to found, started as a club. The members dined together, gave or watched lectures and demonstrations, and argued about the results. In the 1680s, Wren and Hooke started their own philosophical club, which seems to have consisted mostly of drinking and talking. In the 18th century, we see political clubs like the Kit Kat Club. Oh, now there, something interesting. The Kit Kat Club, Freemasonry grew up in that context, although it became one of the most successful and longer-lasting, changing as it did so into a more elaborate thing together. Now, if you want to know more about the account on the Kit Kat Club, this is a political club, go and get a book by a fellow by the name of Field. His first initial is O, and it's simply called The Kit Kat Club. It was published by HarperCollins in 2008. Interesting stuff. I won't get into that today. We'll come back to that another time. But the formats. We borrowed the formats. We used good ideas. Format worked. So, product of the time, from the penny universities to this spread in London of social clubs. I like to think that part of what gave structure to Freemasonry was the fact that it was the toffs and the aristocracy that were producing a lot of the early members, because you had to have certain privilege to be educated, to be literate. And is it an affront to my values today? Well, suck it up. I'm talking about something, 300 years ago? So get over it. I'm not talking about as if today is then. Not in this frame of reference, no. Very self-conscious. Socially class conscious. The most dramatic change came about in about 1717, when those four London lodges joined and formed a Grand Lodge. There have been changes going on before that, and the introduction of lectures and stuff like that. So it wasn't like, oh, gee, here's a genius. This was the evolution of different ideas. In that decade that followed, the number of lodges expanded rapidly, and the system of degrees became more elaborate. And of course, we have to have bureaucracy. And of course, well, first we had constitution. Absolute legitimacy. Yes. Hear, hear. But then we had to develop bureaucrats. The system got larger. And what do bureaucrats do best? Rules. Create rules. The same thing that forms the basis of middle-class society. Rules. As long as everybody plays by the rules, we're fine. You cheat and break the rules, we're unhappy. So a lot of lodges happened. And lodges were required to start keeping records. Our bureaucrats were good bureaucrats. Oh, are we supposed to have sacred cows here? Excuse me. Masonic bureaucrats are sacred cows, and I know I'll burn and burst into flames because I think of them as bureaucrats. But good Lord, man. This is not the time or the place to tell that story, but the key issue to remember is that Freemasonry in Wren's time was not what it is today. It was a type of dining club, and many members were still drawn from the building trades, and its ritual element was relatively simple, and it had a single ceremony. The last part of the picture in Wren's connection with Freemasonry. We know Wren knew many people who were Masons. Some were people like Robert Moray, who he knew through the Royal Society. Others were the craftsmen he works with. An insight into this can be gained from one of the few sources that we do have about the period, And this was an entry in Elias Ashmole's diary. Yeah, Ashmolean Museum at Oxford. Yeah, all of that. This is from the 10th of March, 1682. All secretaries make note that he actually describes something. Doesn't get into, the way you look at the records and recounting of lodge meetings, it's like the lodge doesn't have a pulse. It's like this dead, mindless entity. About 5 p.m., I read a summons to appear at a lodge to be held the next day at Mason's Hall, London. Accordingly, I went, and about noon were admitted into the Fellowship of Freemasons. Sir William Wilson Knight, Captain Rich Borthwick, Mr. Will Woodman, Mr. William Gray, Mr. Samuel Taylor. I was the senior fellow amongst them, it being 35 years since I was admitted, and there were present besides me the fellows afternamed. Mr. Thomas Wise, master of the Masons Company this present year, Mr. Thomas Shorthose, Mr. Shadbolt, Wainsforth Esquire, Mr. Niche Young, what a beautiful name, N-I-C-H, Niche Young, Mr. John Shorthose, Mr. William Hammond, Mr. John Thompson, and Mr. William Stanton. Of the 15 people named above, Wren knew or had worked with 10. Ashmole, the writer, Sir William Wilson, Mr. William Gray, Mr. Samuel Taylor, Mr. Thomas Wise, Mr. Thomas Shorthose, Nicholas Young, John Shorthose, Mr. William Hammond, and Stanton, and John, William Stanton, and John Thompson. In summary, Wren knew many Masons. He was a person who habitually joined clubs. He was a founder of the Royal Society, founded his own philosophical club, was a member, a college fellow, and he was, of course, connected with the building world. He was, in other words, just the sort of person who might have joined Freemasonry and had all the connections to do so. The question then is, did he? So, come on back. I'm going to leave you hanging just a little bit. The next part we're going to talk about is James Anderson and the creation of the myth of Wren as the Grand Master. That you'll be okay with that? I hope so. And I hope I'll see you again. Come back. We have a few tunes to play you out of the show today. And a bit of it periodical, yeah. Of course. Something of acclaim. Pay attention to what's important in your life, the small things that have great meaning. Be pleased with your contribution to the community. Protect yourself and your family and watch out over each other. Remember, the great architect of the universe is thinking about you. Here's a few tunes that are sort of pensive, because it's sort of that day after the rains and the storms, and health is returning to the earth, and everybody will get out there and enjoy a few degrees of sunshine today, as only we can do here in Canada. Do it in other places, but not quite the same. I look forward to seeing you next week at Masonic Companion. I hope you found it interesting and informative. Cheers.
Hello darkness, my old friend, I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of hollow stone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon. talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one did.
Just like me.